Another Point of View, a program which seeks to provide our listeners with thoughtful, insightful news and commentary from a range of political perspectives on current issues in the U.S. I'm Michael Howe.
And I'm Bob Golden. Together, we'll be reading selected articles from the online news service Tangle. Tangle is an independent, nonpartisan, and subscriber-supported media organization that covers the major political stories in the U.S. Tangle seeks to produce truly non-biased reporting on current events by providing responsible views from across the political spectrum in every single article, clearly labeling that what is opinion and what isn't.
It's important to note that the views and opinions expressed on this program are those of the article authors and publishers and not necessarily reflect the views of the Audio Journal, its staff, or the volunteer readers. With that introduction, let's dive into a couple of articles from the current news cycle. Here's Bob with our first article.
Thank you, Michael. Our first article for today's program comes from the Tangle newsletter of June 25th. The Supreme Court's Religious Liberties Ruling. On Tuesday, June 23rd, the Supreme Court ruled 6-3 that federal law protecting prisoners' religious exercise does not extend to a lawsuit brought by an incarcerated Ratafarian man who sought damages after prison officials forcibly shaved his head. The man, Damon Landor, sued both the Louisiana Department of Corrections and several of its officers individually under the Religious Land Use and Institutionalized Person Act, which defines the religious rights of people held in institutions that receive federal funding. However, the court's majority found that the law does not apply to the prison officials named in the suit, as they had not entered into a formal agreement with the federal government. Backup. In 2020, Landor was transferred to Raymond Laborde Correctional Center in Louisiana while serving a 5-month sentence for drug possession. As a member of Rastafari, a religion originating in Jamaica in which maintaining dreadlocks fulfills a religious vow, Landor determined never to cut his hair. However, prison guards attempted to shave his head upon arrival at the new facility. He protested and showed a prison guard a copy of the appellate court decision holding that RLUIAPA prohibited the prison from removing his dreadlocks. He was eventually handcuffed and shaved after officials dismissed his complaints. Afterward, he filed a suit seeking monetary damages from the Department of Correction and prison officials. A district court and the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Fifth Circuit dismissed the claims against the department itself and ruled against Landor, but the Supreme Court agreed to hear the case in June 2025. Oral arguments were held in November. Writing for the majority, Justice Neil Gorsuch said that RLUIPA does not apply to individual prison officials as they had not entered any agreement with the federal government and knowingly consented to answer private suits under RLUIPA. Gorsuch suggested that allowing Randor's claim to proceed would give Congress effectively unbridled police power, as it could regulate a private individual's conduct if they received pay from a receipt of federal funds. Mr. Landor's case cannot proceed against them any more than a breach of contract action might proceed against a defendant who never formed a contract, Gorsuch said. The court's three Democratic-appointed justices dissented. Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson wrote, "Neither respondents nor the court contests Congress's power to impose RLUIPA's substantive directive accommodating religious freedom, but the majority adopts the peculiar position that Congress is powerless to create and a state is powerless to accept the natural next step, a damages remedy against officials who violate that directive. But insulating individuals from lawsuits, even if they violate the law," she continued, "the ruling ensures that prisoners like Landor, who suffer violations of the religious freedom in state prisons, no matter how blatant, will often be left remediless." In the newsletter, will share perspectives from the political left and right on the decision, followed by Associate Editor Audrey Moorhead's take on the court's ruling. It's worth noting that commentators on both sides of the issue agree that Lando's rights were violated and question whether existing law adequately protects religious liberties. Now here's Michael with views from the political left.
Thanks, Bob. First, we'll hear what those on the political left are saying. The highlights. The left criticizes the decision for undercutting religious liberty. Some suggest the current court only supports religious freedom for certain groups. Others say prisoners now have no pathway for recourse if their religious rights are violated. In the online magazine Slate, Alexis Romero and Mark Joseph Stern called the decision, quote, a wrecking ball to a major religious liberty law, close quote. Romero and Stern wrote, throughout the opinion, the court analogized Congress' spending power to a contract between the federal government and the states. To the majority, every detail of that contract must be knowingly consented to by all parties who might be affected. But the Religious Land Use and Institutionalized Persons Act, or RLUIPA, is legislation, not a contract. So, as Jackson wrote, it's doubtful that the Constitution actually requires this unrealistic level of contractual clarity. Moreover, the state officials in this case arguably did agree to be bound by federal law. After all, they signed an employment contract with a prison that receives federal funding by virtue of RLUIPA. State officials are trained on their inmates' rights, and prison litigation has been around for centuries under RLUIPA and other statutes. There's no serious argument that these state officials were blind to the consequences that might come from violating the rights of the prisoners they are in charge of. When Landor tried to vindicate his rights, the Supreme Court didn't just refuse to recognize them, but took the opportunity to issue a sweeping change in constitutional law that risks hobbling a host of important federal protections. In The Nation, Ellie Mistel argued, quote, the Supreme Court loves religious freedom, just not for Rastafarians, close quote. Mistel wrote, usually, the Supreme Court treats the Free Exercise Clause as if it was written on a Dead Sea Scroll. But this case raises the question of whether their religious tolerance extends only to the right kinds of Christians. Indeed, the way the court squared its normally robust protection of religious freedom with its decision to allow Landor's rights to be flagrantly violated was to pretend the case wasn't about religion at all. Gorsuch devotes all of one paragraph to the First Amendment violation at the heart of the case. Instead, he casts the whole thing as an examination of Congress's power under the spending clause. Gorsuch argues that employees of institutions that accept federal funds have to agree to be sued under the RLUIPA before such lawsuits can proceed. The entire structure of civil rights laws is based on the premise that receiving federal dollars makes you subject to federal rules and consequences. Gorsuch would throw that entire premise into the trash. In his world, you are only subject to federal civil rights laws if you personally agree to follow them. In Religious News Service, Elizabeth Reiner Platt said, quote, religious freedom depends on who you are, close quote. Platt wrote, the opinion, authored by Justice Neil Gorsuch, held that in order to be subject to suit, prison employees must, quote, voluntarily and knowingly consent to answer lawsuits under, close quote, the RLUIPA, something employees are unlikely to agree to. Without any threat of financial punishment, employees of state jails and prisons can trample inmates' religious rights with impunity. And while courts may still order prisons to accommodate incarcerated people's religious beliefs, such as by providing halal meals, this means little in cases like Landor's when the damage has already been done. Even this non-financial relief can be avoided, as prisons frequently move incarcerated people between facilities to evade liability for rights violations. Landor himself was transferred between three different facilities in the course of 6 months. Rather than being a deviation from the Supreme Court's broad view of religious liberty rights, Tuesday's Landor decision is part of a long-standing pattern. While religious liberty claims have been brought and won by people from many different backgrounds and walks of life, including people in prison, the path is often far harder for those who face obstacles within our larger judicial system. And now, next up, Bob will have what the political right is saying.
Thanks, Michael. And here's what the political right is saying. The highlights. The right is mixed, with some saying this is an issue for Congress. Many say the case result shows prisons do not have adequate legal remedies for religious freedom violations. Others argue that Landor's religious rights were violated. The Wall Street Journal editorial board argues religious prisoners need Congress's help. The board wrote, Mr. Landor should have been protected by the Religious Land Use and Institutionalized Persons Act, RLUIPA. But what recourse does he have now? No court can restore his hair. He can't sue Louisiana for damages because of sovereignty immunity. So he wanted to sue the prison officials personally. Unfortunately for him, that law has federalism problems. Under RLUIPA, Justice Neil Gorsuch writes, state prison systems that take federal money must agree not to substantially burden religious exercise. Individual prison guards, however, aren't a party to that bargain. That's if Congress doesn't act. To be sure, Justice Gorsuch says, Mr. Landor and the dissent identify ways in which Congress could have lawfully imposed personal liability. The board said, is it possible for lawmakers to find that kind of agreement? RLUIPA passed in 2000 by unanimous consent. But in these polarized days, Democrats often treat religious liberty as if it's code for right-wing agenda. Mr. Landau's case is evidence it isn't, and Congress can act for religious prisoners of all faiths. In the Daily Signal, Cully, Simpson, and Helen Nugent suggests the case was decided by a narrow legal question. Stimson and Nugent wrote, the issue in the case that made its way to the Supreme Court wasn't whether the officer's conduct was outrageous. It was. The narrow legal question presented to the Supreme Court was whether appropriate relief under the Religious Land Use and Institutionalized Persons Act may include money damages and suits against government officials in their individual capacities. In this case, Louisiana's Department of Corrections accepted federal funding and agreed to comply with RLUIPA's requirements, but the individual correction officers employed by LDOC did not. Because Congress lacks a general power to regulate individuals through the spending clause, the court concluded that personal liability may be imposed only on parties who knowingly and voluntarily consent to conditions attached to federal funds. Stimson and Nugent said, the dissent said the majority magically transforms a federal statute into an invitation to be accepted or declined, deemed binding only if each particular defendant has explicitly agreed to be penalized. As a result, prison officials will have little incentive to accommodate the free exercise rights of prisoners, knowing full well that if they violate the law, they won't be held personally liable. In the National Catholic Register, Andrea Bacote Bayer said the prison officials should be able to walk away with no consequences. Bacote Bayer wrote, "It is worth setting aside at the outset a concern that opening the courthouse doors to prisoners on religious liberty claims would flood federal courts with frivolous lawsuits. It would not. RLUIPA does not give prisoners the right to ignore prison rules. Officials may restrict or burden religious practice when they can show a compelling reason and when they use the least intrusive means to achieve it. Under the Prison Litigation Reform Act, any prisoner who wants to sue in federal court must first exhaust every available grievance procedure within the prison system. That requirement alone screens out a large share of potential claims before a judge ever sees them." So the court was never asked to give prisoners a blank check. It was being asked something narrower. When an official disregards the law, can he be held personally liable? Under today's ruling, the answer is no. Congress responded to a 1990 decision that weakened the Free Exercise Clause by passing RLUIPA to provide a shield to the religious liberties of prisoners. Today's opinion confirms that the shield lacks a corresponding sword when it comes to holding individual officials accountable. Now we'll conclude this article with Michael reading the Tangle editor's take.
Thanks, Bob. We'll finish up this first reading with the Tangle Associate Editor Audrey Moorhead's take on this Supreme Court ruling. The highlights. Landor's religious rights were clearly violated, which no one involved with this case disputes. Redressing his harm, nonetheless, sets up a surprising paradox between the extent of Congress's authority and individual rights. I'm truly torn between the majority and minority opinions on this case, and I sincerely hope Congress will act to settle any future issues. This case has been a genuine head-scratcher for me since I first started following it in October. At first glance, it seemed like a typical religious liberties case. A citizen's rights were most likely violated, but a lack of clarity in the law brought him before the Supreme Court to litigate the minutia. But the issues at play go far deeper. I want to lay out the one indisputable fact here. Damon Lander suffered an unconscionable and, more importantly in matters of law, unconstitutional violation of his religious liberties. For months, Lander had been serving prison time for his crimes, which restricted most of his personal freedoms while protecting his rights, including the right to religious observance. Two government facilities honored those rights without incident before his final prison transfer, with only 3 weeks left on his sentence, close enough to freedom to taste it. Then, despite his best efforts to invoke his constitutional and, as he argued, statutory rights, he was forcibly restrained and those rights were violated. And that violation was fundamentally irredeemable. No matter how much the law is on Lander's side, the state of Louisiana could not grow Lander's hair back. I'm disturbed by basically every detail of his story. But for some reason, I've been especially struck on the fact that his hair was cut very near the end of his prison sentence. The timing doesn't make the act any more or less wrong, of course, but I can't help but imagine how being so close to the end of his sentence could sharpen the sting. I don't think that anyone who hears that story could honestly say that Lander didn't suffer a grievous injury under the law. I also don't think anyone could say that Lander's case is a one-off, this sort of discrimination that could happen to anyone with sincerely held religious beliefs, though the danger is certainly greater for people like Lander. The Rastafari movement in the U.S. is small and ethnically concentrated, leaving people more prone to misunderstanding or disregarding their beliefs. I think most people would say that the Religious Land Use and Institutionalized Persons Act was practically designed for people like Lander to have some recourse, and at first I assumed the court would decide unanimously, or nearly so, in his favor. RLUIPA is supposed to give citizens who have their religious liberties violated the ability to sue for redress. But on Tuesday, the Supreme Court ruled that Lander could not sue the prison guards who personally cut off his hair. In Justice Neil Gorsuch's view, the spending clause of the Constitution limits the law's application. When Congress attaches strings to federal funding, like telling states they must recognize religious rights and agree to answer lawsuits from individuals in order to receive it, it creates a contract between the federal government and the states. But Congress doesn't create a contract with each individual state employee, meaning those employees have not given their, quote, voluntary and knowing consent, close quote, to the law's requirement that they answer lawsuits. In this case, Gorsuch argues RLUIPA doesn't provide Lander with a method to seek redress from state employees. On first reading, Gorsuch's constitutional logic basically made sense to me, even if it grates against my religious freedom principles. But Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson's emphatic dissent threw a wrench in the gears. Jackson argues that the majority's reasoning, and particularly Gorsuch's contract analogy, doesn't hold up. Instead, it separates rights and remedies through a sleight of hand. Jackson argues that RLUIPA gives Lander the ability to sue the guards for monetary damages, a question that Gorsuch said the court didn't need to directly answer yet, simply because the court has already interpreted the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, which it has long read as a sister law, to allow for them. Furthermore, Lander should be able to sue the guards because Congress intended for his case of action, the facts or events on which he can sue, to be valid under the law. And anyway, the law is no secret, so prison guards should be expected to abide by it even if they don't formally enter into a contract. Thus, in this apparent religious freedom case, the difference between Gorsuch and Jackson isn't over Lander's religious rights and guarantees. It's over federalism and congressional power. Gorsuch argues that allowing lawsuits against state employees without formal contracts under the spending clause would massively expand Congress's regulatory power over individual behavior. Jackson retorts that Congress already has that power. The fundamental split here is between their vastly different views of the limits of Congress's authority under the Constitution, a difference consistent with the rest of their jurisprudence. I thought SCOTUS expert Sarah Isger put it well. Gorsuch and the majority are typically more concerned with limiting federal power, while Jackson and the dissenters are typically more concerned with enhancing citizens' power to seek redress against the government. Having said all that, I'll deliver my honest take. I am not sure who's right. I'm a sucker for generalizable principles of law, so Gorsuch's argument for unilaterally treating spending clause power as an affair of contracts and consent is appealing. It's a broad principle that could apply to more laws than just RLUIPA, and it could protect state employees from being made to behave in discordance with their personal beliefs by an act of Congress. I imagine that's why Gorsuch reached for culture war examples as potential threats of overreach. On the other hand, I'm solidly with Jackson that citizens like Lander should be able to seek some sort of recourse for their rights violations, and she certainly made a strong case for court precedent being on her side. Being evenly split between their arguments has given me a strange detachment from the case. I find myself in the position of accepting the result basically neutrally, and thinking instead about how redress for religious liberties violations can move forward. It truly frustrates me that Damon Lander himself remains without recourse. But to its credit, the court did give Congress a roadmap to ensure that future citizens in Lander's position can get justice for the violations of their rights. Congress could require individual agents to enter into contracts with the federal government, or it could require states to enact their own laws guaranteeing the ability to seek redress. In either case, the Roberts Court seems to be continuing its established trend of asking Congress to do a better job of making laws. I sincerely hope that Congress takes it up on the challenge. Now, please stay tuned to Audio Journal. Bob and I will be back with a second article after a brief pause.
Stay tuned. There's more ahead.
You are listening to Another Point of View, a production of Audio Journal.
Our second and final article for today's program is from the Tangle newsletter of June the 29th. Two major Supreme Court rulings on immigration. On Thursday, June the 25th, the Supreme Court issued two decisions on U.S. immigration policy. In the first case, Mullen v. El Otro Lado, the court ruled 6-3 that the federal government can turn back asylum seekers before they cross into the United States. In the second, Mullen v. Doe, the court also ruled 6-3 that courts cannot review Department of Homeland Security determinations on groups' eligibility for temporary protected status, or TPS, clearing the way for the Trump administration to remove Haitian and Syrian TPS holders from the U.S. Background on the asylum cases. Roughly 10 years ago, under President Barack Obama, Customs and Border Protection, or CBP, officers adopted a policy called metering, in which they turned back non-citizens, including asylum seekers, at the U.S.-Mexico border before they could physically cross into the United States. The plaintiffs alleged this policy violated federal law, allowing any person, quote, who arrives in the United States, close quote, to access the asylum process, arguing arrival at U.S. ports of entry falls under that provision. The U.S. Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit sided with the plaintiffs, ruling that asylum seekers who arrived at ports of entry had functionally arrived in the country. The majority struck down that decision. Justice Samuel Alito wrote, "In ordinary speech, no one would say that a person arrives in a place, for example, a house, a city, or a country, before the person enters that place." Later adding, "A running back does not arrive in the end zone when he reaches the one-yard line." He also noted that Congress could have specified that asylum seekers arriving at the border should have their claims heard, but it did not. The court's three Democratic-appointed justices dissented, and Justice Sonia Sotomayor responded directly to several of Alito's conclusions. "It would not be premature to say someone arrives in San Francisco while she is still driving on the Golden Gate Bridge. The meanings of the phrases arrives in and arriving in depend on context," she wrote. Separately, Sotomayor argued that the decision creates a perverse incentive because asylum seekers will now seek to enter the U.S. illegally in order to have their claims heard. Background on the TPS case. Congress established the Temporary Protective Status Program for citizens of countries impacted by natural disaster, armed conflict, or other extraordinary and temporary situations. Obama administration DHS Secretary Janet Napolitano gave the designation to Haiti in 2010 following a devastating earthquake and gave the designation to Syria in 2012 amid then President Bashar al-Assad's violent crackdown on dissent. Those designations would last up to 18 months at a time, were repeatedly extended until 2025, when then DHS Secretary Kristi Noem moved to end both. Groups of Haitian and Syrian nationals challenged the decision and asked the court to block their removal from the country while those challenges played out in lower courts. Justice Alito, again, writing for the majority, held that the law creating TPS does not permit judicial review of a DHS secretary's decision to terminate TPS for a group. The term determination can be used to describe either an individual decision or the whole process leading to a final decision, he wrote. Alito also rejected the plaintiff's claim that the Trump administration's decision to end the designation was motivated by racial animus, acknowledging heated language used by President Donald Trump about Haitian immigrants, but finding that Noem could have plausibly made her decision for a litany of policy-related reasons. The court's three Democratic-appointed justices again dissented. Justice Elena Kagan argued that federal law does allow judicial review of certain aspects of the TPS determination, like the procedural steps the secretary must undertake prior to making any determination about country conditions. She also suggested that the Haitian plaintiffs were likely to succeed in their argument that racism was a motivating factor in the determination, violating equal protection under the Constitution. In this newsletter, we'll hear views from the political left and the political right on these immigration rulings. Then, executive editor Isaac Saul weighs in with his take. Now here's Bob with the opinions from the political right.
Thank you, Michael. First, we'll hear what many on the political right are saying. The highlights. The right mostly support the ruling, with many arguing that the court upheld the intent of the law. Some say the decision rectified judicial intrusions into executive authority. Others say the majority erred by discounting racial animus in the TPS case. The Washington Examiner editorial board wrote, "The Supreme Court just made securing the border easier." The board wrote, "The court held that temporary protected status is indeed temporary. An alien is not in the United States till they are in the United States." These simple declarations that words mean what they say, that statutory limits must be enforced as written, will make it easier for future presidents to preserve the border security Trump has achieved. Open borders activists claim that as soon as an alien intending to enter the U.S. encounters a U.S. official at the border, even if that alien is still in Mexico, that should qualify under the statute as arriving in the U.S. Writing for the 6-3 majority, Justice Samuel Alito was having none of it. For too long, lower federal courts have treated immigration statutes not as law to be enforced, but as invitations to impose open border policies that Congress refused to enact. Presidents cannot secure the border if judges are free to redefine the word in to mean outside or temporary to mean permanent. The Supreme Court restored the ordinary meaning of those words and, with it, a principle of self-government. Immigration law is written by Congress and enforced by the president, not rewritten by district court judges at the behest of activist groups. In the New York Post, Ilya Shapiro said, "Presidential power trumps leftist lawfare." Shapiro wrote, "President Donald Trump has pushed the envelope of his authority. The court has generally let him do so, except, as in the tariff case, when he treads on clear congressional prerogatives." The court in Mullen v. Al Etro, Lato, found that an alien standing in Mexico does not arrive in the United States by attempting or failing to set foot in this country. That's important because the Immigration and Nationality Act gives the right to apply for asylum only to aliens who are in the country, a requirement that lower courts were looking to thwart. The Democratic-appointed justice proved unwilling to defer to executive determinations, even those made under the discretion of outlined in the INA's text. Each time they supported the legal challenges that are actually policy disagreements. But it's not up to the courts to make immigration determinations. Whether you like what this or any other administration does in the immigration space, Congress has legislated, for good or evil, in a way that gives expansive power to the executive branch here. In the Washington Post, George F. Will argues the Supreme Court errs in this immigration ruling. Will wrote, "DHS Secretary Kristi Noem's behavior egregiously violated the pertinent law, but was shielded from judicial rebuke by the court's majority too mechanical textualism about the secretary's determination, meaning decision, and by a blinkered non-recognition of the animus behind Noem's action. The law required Noem to review conditions in Haiti after consulting with appropriate government agencies. Instead, she made her decision, then conducted a make-believe consultation. Noem was implementing the president's proclaimed animus even against immigrants who are in America legally, but whom he considered icky." Kagan says, "Prior court rulings established that the Haitians needed to show only that a racially discriminatory purpose was a motivating factor in the determination of Haiti's TPS designation." Well, Noem's former employer has said Haitians were eating Ohio pets. Was race on the president's mind? Donald Trump has clarified this. Why is it we only take people from shithole countries like Haiti and Somalia? Why can't we have some nice people from Norway and Sweden? Next is Michael with viewpoints from the political left.
Thanks, Bob. And now for what many on the political left are saying. The highlights. The left strongly opposes both rulings, with many saying the TPS decision was legally and morally wrong. Others question Alito's contextualist analysis in the asylum case. Still others say the laws are at the root of the decisions must be changed. In the New York Times, Elora Mukherjee called the TPS decision a slap in the face of two immigrants who followed the law. Mukherjee wrote, "Lawyers for the plaintiffs had argued in April that courts have an obligation to ensure that the TPS termination decision is not based on whims or racist ideology. In considering the challenge to the termination of TPS for Syria, on November 18, 2025, Federal District Court Judge Catherine Polk Fela noted that all the Trump administration terminations, quote, have involved non-European, majority non-white populations, close quote. Justice Elena Kagan pointed out in her dissent that Donald Trump had repeatedly used repellent and racially inflected statements regarding immigrants, notoriously insisting Haitians are eating dogs and baselessly commenting that Haitians in America could have AIDS. The dissent further warned of the devastation that will result as TPS holders are, quote, put on the next plane back to Haiti or Syria, close quote. TPS holders nationwide have been bracing for the worst, and now it's here. Family separations, loss of employment, and deportations. In both Syria and Haiti, there is a risk of terrorism, kidnapping, and armed conflict. As far off as it may seem, congressional action is now the only way forward. Any new TPS statute should explicitly provide for judicial review of termination decisions, effectively overruling Thursday's devastating Supreme Court decision. In Slate, Robin Nicole Sanders said, Alito's textualism has entered the realm of the absurd. Sanders wrote, the question before the court in the asylum case was whether someone standing at an official point of entry on the Mexican side of the border has already arrived, or whether arrival occurs only after physically crossing into American soil. The court chose the latter. Under that reading, until an asylum seeker takes that final step, the government's statutory obligation to inspect the person and begin the asylum process never arises. The majority acknowledges that its reading recreates some overlap in the statute, but concludes that a modest amount of redundancy is preferable to giving words an unnatural meaning. Justice Sonia Sotomayor's dissent points towards an alternative reading. Rather than treating arrives in the United States as a freestanding phrase, she reads it alongside the statute's repeated mandatory commands. Congress provided that immigration officers shall inspect arriving non-citizens and shall refer those expressing a fear of prosecution into the asylum process. Congress did not establish a system in which executive officials could decide through a physical positioning alone whether those mandatory duties would ever arise. It established a process designed to ensure that people presenting themselves for admission at designated ports of entry would first be inspected before the government decided whether they could enter, should be removed, or allowed to pursue asylum. That reading is no less textualist. In America magazine, the editors suggested the rulings, quote, reveal a profound moral failure, close quote. The editors wrote, regarding Haitian TPS holders in particular, the court's ruling would mean returning more than 300,000 people to a country dominated by gang violence, largely without a functioning government, to which Americans are warned against traveling and to whose capital city American commercial airlines are forbidden to fly. In the second case, the court allowed the administration to close the country to asylum seekers. Effectively, the court decided that the administration can refuse to allow immigrants to arrive in the legally relevant sense at ports of entry, thus turning them away before they can even present a case for asylum under U.S. law. The results of these decisions, whether or not they are legal and constitutional, are profoundly immoral and unjust. They portray the United States' history as a country of immigrants and are a wound on the American conscience. If the law requires allowing an administration to deport hundreds of thousands of people into mortal peril after it has attacked them with vile and racist lies, then justice demands that the law be reformed. If the Constitution is to be interpreted to allow the president to determine in advance that effectively no one is eligible for asylum, no matter what laws Congress has passed, then the Constitution needs to be amended to strengthen the separation of powers that safeguards American liberty and self-governance. And we'll conclude this news article with the Tangle editor's take on the issue. Now here's Bob again.
Thank you, Michael. A wrap up the second and final Tangle newsletter with editor Isaac Saul's take on these two immigration decisions handed down by the U.S. Supreme Court. The highlights. The majority has a strong legal argument on asylum. The court's TPS ruling is reasonable, but raises practical concerns. Without congressional intervention, I worry the ruling would create more chaos in the immigration system. Whenever I write about the Supreme Court rulings, I try to separate my thoughts into two buckets, the logic of the legal arguments and the practical outcomes of the ruling. I'll do that again today for both of these cases. Let's start with the asylum case. On the merits, Justice Alito's legal rationale mostly makes sense to me. His argument about the plain English meaning of arrives in resonates with me, and this interpretation is reasonably applied here. As he noted in his opinion, immigration law frequently distinguishes between actual entrance into the U.S. and attempted entrance. So it's fair to conclude that if Congress had wanted every asylum seeker who reached a port of entry to be able to apply for asylum, it would have said so expressly. But Alito's several analogies for this distinction, such as a running back reaching the one-yard line of the end zone versus actually stepping into the end zone, didn't sit quite well with me. I'll put it more like this. If I were invited over to a friend's house for dinner, pulled up on the street in front of their house and parked, then called them to say, "I've arrived," I would find it supremely odd if that friend said, "No, you didn't. You're on the street. Call me when you're at the front door." But if I said, "I've arrived in your house," then that would be odd, given that I was on the street. I might quibble with Alito's analogies, but I think the gist of his point is sound. On the other hand, the civil rights attorney, Robin Nicole Sanders, writing in Slate, under what the left is saying, made a great argument that Alito's analysis missed the full context of Congress's intent for asylum system. As she noted, Congress laid out clear instructions for immigration officers when someone arrives in the U.S. In the context of those instructions were obviously for ports of entry. The broader statute that contains this precise wording does seem to imply that Congress is making rules for what to do when someone shows up at a port of entry, not just when someone crosses into U.S. territory at a port of entry. The semantics, hair-splitting debates underscores the court's important role in resolving legal questions that can hinge on a word or two. Nothing about the majority's decision feels egregiously out of bounds to me. In fact, on the strict interpretation of the law, I think it's how I would have ended up voting myself. This is a law. I want it to be technical, tight, and straightforward. And in that sense, I think it's very fair to hold the line that arrives in means literally arriving in the United States, as Alito defines it. However, the impact of this ruling worries me. Our asylum system is broken, and metering is an effective way to slow down things. In 2024, when I laid out my bipartisan resolution to fixing immigration system, I put tightening the asylum system atop the list of Republican-led ideas I'd support. Any non-citizen, including economic migrants, can currently cross the border illegally and immediately turn themselves in for processing as asylum seekers. We have to enter them into the asylum process. Most end up not qualifying once their claims are actually heard, yet the system acts as a gigantic loophole for migrants who want to come here illegally and spend years inside the United States before their claims are heard, sometimes disappearing with the country once they're inside. I want to fix that problem. This ruling may well make it worse. Now, rather than show up at legal ports of entry, how many more migrants will attempt to cross illegally? And how much disorganization and instability will that inject into the system? Unless Congress rewrites or amends the law, we're likely to see more chaos and more wild swings in policy across different administrations. My feelings about the temporary protected status, PTS case, were even more mixed. On the base level, it would be odd if one Department of Homeland Security secretary could create and repeatedly extend TPS designations, but another couldn't end them. TPS designation for Haitian and Syrian migrants were first made in 2010 and 2012, respectively. They were supposed to last for 18 months, but repeatedly extended until last year, which makes a mockery of the word temporary. Ultimately, if former DHS Secretary Kristi Noem was determined that these TPS designations are no longer necessary or no longer serve the interests of the United States, she seemed well within her legal authority to end them. Making determinations about these programs is literally the DHS Secretary's job. But this case raises a few core legal questions. They created a mess for the court. One question is whether courts can actually review the determination of the DHS secretary. This seems straightforward. The TPS statute bars judicial review of any determination of the Secretary of Homeland Security with respect to the designation or termination or extension of a designation of a foreign state. I'm not sure how much clearer it can get, even if I find it absurd that we created a non-court review law. It should be changed immediately, lest it be further abused by this administration and future ones. But the challenger's claim was slightly different. They argue that while they cannot challenge the substance of Noem's decision, they can challenge the procedures she took to get there. It's sort of akin to saying, yes, I had the drugs on me, but I was illegally searched, so the charges should be thrown out. It turns out that Noem, whose incompetence I warned about the moment she was nominated, took a quintessentially incompetent path to get to her decision. She did not adequately consult the appropriate agencies, the State Department, about conditions in Syria or Haiti to make a determination as required by law. Rather than dispute whether Noem's two email exchanges, one for each country with a State Department official, constitutes a legal review, Alito simply said that the TPS judicial review bar expressly restricts review. He seems right, though. Again, the law's language seems absurd and appears that Noem genuinely violated procedural rules to get to her predetermined conclusion. It's a beautiful concoction of incompetence, bad law, and inelastic jurisprudence. Alito also concluded that a constitutional challenge to the termination of Haiti's designation on the grounds that termination was racially motivated would likely fail. To his credit, he notes that poverty and deprivation are no reflection on character, and there's no justification for denigrating the character of Haitians who suffer from and bear no responsibility for the country's ills. Still, I think the challengers had the best argument on this point. Most of us know the comments by heart now, though Justice Kagan helpfully listed them in her dissent. Trump has suggested Haitians and other immigrants were poisoning the blood of America, that Haitians probably have AIDS, that they're eating dogs and cats, that allowing them in is like a death wish for our country. He has also mused about why we only take people from shithole countries like Haiti and Somalia, and not more from Norway and Sweden. Alito's suggestion that none of these statements were overly racial or that they could rest on reason that have nothing to do with race is, to me, farcical. I'm practically sensitive about these things in an era where far too much is chalked up to racism, sexism, anti-Semitism, ableism, etc. But come on. Trump has used dehumanizing language specifically and repeatedly about Haitians in black majority countries, while other majority white countries with genuine, if lesser, instability and corruption get diplomatic courtship, business deals, and silence. We don't have to be 100% certain that Trump is racist to make an evidentiary argument that he has racial animosity towards Haitians, and the law doesn't require race to be the sole or dominant cause of action, only a motivating factor. short of Trump's standing up and saying, I don't want Haitians here because they are black, I'm not sure what would qualify. And frankly, they're poisoning the blood of our country to describe illegal immigrants is pretty damn close. So now what? The practical implication is that hundreds of thousands of Haitians and thousands of Syrians who have been living here are likely to be forced to go back to their country or forced into hiding to avoid deportation. Meanwhile, a future Democratic administration could say, issue a 50-year TPS to any country of its liking. And that is apparently not something any court can review, no matter how incompetent it is done. Even on the heels of an admittedly complex set of legal questions, this outcome seems quite bad, and without congressional intervention, the downstream effects of it will be felt long past the Trump administration.
That concludes our program for today. We hope you have enjoyed listening to Another Point of View, a program that gives a voice to both sides of the debate on current events and important contemporary issues. This program is a production of The Audio Journal, a proud member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network. The views and opinions expressed on this program are those of the article authors and publishers and do not necessarily reflect the views of The Audio Journal, its staff, or the volunteer readers. Archived editions of this or any previous program are available on our website, audiojournal.org, or by using the Audio Journal app on your iPhone, iPad, or Android device.
We've been reading original copyrighted material from the news service Tangle with their express permission. Tangle is an award-winning media organization that covers the major political stories in the U.S. It is independent, nonpartisan, and subscriber-supported, with a newsletter read by over 400,000 people in 55-plus countries across the world, and a podcast that reaches hundreds of thousands of listeners every month. Their audience is made up of conservatives, liberals, independents, and those who don't identify with any particular political tribe. Free podcasts can be heard on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. In addition to their free email newsletter, news articles, and podcasts, Tangle also provides a variety of rich subscriber-only content, including special news articles, in-depth investigative reports, and interviews with current newsmakers. To learn more about Tangle and find out how you can subscribe, call the Audio Journal offices at 508-797-1117.
This program is supported by the Worcester Memorial Foundation for the Blind, the Massachusetts Commission for the Blind, and from generous contributions from listeners like you. Thank you. Our regular program schedule can be found on our website, audiojournal.org, or a printed version in large print or braille by calling the Audio Journal offices at 508-797-1117. Please remember, we need your feedback. How can we improve the program to better serve you, the listener? Call or email us with any suggestions or general feedback. We want to hear from you. This is Michael Hauck.
And I'm Bob Golden. Thank you for listening, and we hope you'll tune in again next week. Please stay tuned to Audio Journal. More great programming is coming your way.
This is not a public service announcement. This is a one-minute mystery.
In Duncan's cottage, where the temperature was below freezing, there was a newspaper, a fireplace, some kindling, and a kerosene lamp. What should Duncan light first?
And here's the solution to our mystery.
First, Duncan should light either a match or a lighter.
And now back to our regular programming.